Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'm Lisa, and I want to welcome you to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax. I'm happy that you're all here tonight. I'm happy that it's a nice day outside. I've been excited about having Joe Henry and Anthony Zerbe here since I found out about it. And Charles is like, but you're working 2 days that week already. I said, no, I want to do this one because I love stories about the West, because I'm a Denver native, and these are wonderful stories that are threaded into a wonderful novel, so I hope you all enjoy it. It's really my pleasure to introduce award-winning author and renowned lyricist Joe Henry, who will talk about his book, Lime Creek. And Joe's friend, who's just upstairs right now, but he is here, Emmy Award winner and amazing character actor Anthony Zerbe, who will read from the book. This is just an extra special night for us because we don't usually get an author and an actor to perform from the book, but Lime Creek is really special because most people know Joe Henry as a talented lyricist who's written songs for John Denver, Emmylou Harris, Garth Brooks, Frank Sinatra, and really too many to list. And when Joe wrote a manuscript of Lime Creek, Anthony Zerbe got his hands on a copy from a friend of his, and he read it, and he wanted to do a performance. And this all culminated in 1996 to the much-acclaimed Prelude to Lime Creek at the Denver Center, Ricketson Theater. Joe Henry spends some of his time in Colorado and some of his time in Nashville because he does write music. And he's received so many awards, including the Colorado Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts, Creative Fellowship Awards in Literature, the National Conservation Achievement Award from the National Wildlife Federation, and others. He received his MFA from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. And then the acclaimed actor Anthony Zerbe won critical praise for his adaptation of and performance in Prelude to Lime Creek. And he's also appeared in so many movies and TV shows. I was looking through the IMDb database, and I thought, oh, my God, I've seen most of these, which means I spend a lot of time watching TV and old movies. But Cool Hand Luke, The Omega Man, which I still remember, Mission Impossible, even The Matrix, really too many to mention. So without further ado, please welcome Joe Henry and Anthony Zerbe.
So this is from a Christmas story in the book. It's called Sleep, and this is about halfway in the story. He's talking. Toe Bowman is one of the neighboring ranchers who plays guitar during this Christmas celebration that takes place in the barn that. Is the family barn of Luke, the protagonist. So the kids would break away from the folks, and the folks would cluster on either side of Toe Bowman with handshakes all around and all the good wishes spoken back and forth from out of that shared existence of people living close enough to the earth to be kin to the various other families of beings who lived there also in that harsh in generally unforgiving environment that made us all, the Bowmans, the next ranch over, nearly 4 miles away, and Ollie Wheeler and his family and hands and their families nearly 15 miles off to the south, all neighbors, folks who worked much longer hours than their work animals from dark to dark and most always beyond, day after day without heed of arbitrary divisions of time, into weeks or months. And so telling the passage of it by the building and diminishing of the light and the waxing and waning of the moon, and perhaps too by the awesome concentric circles of the fiery and yearning stars. And closer to the heart, by the births and deaths of all the creatures given and taken from life around and about our high, clear place on the earth that was rimmed by the near hills on one side and the far mountains on the other, winged and two- and four-legged and silver swimmers and arrow-like flyers and runners, horned and not, with cloven feet and some with 10 toes. The peach fuzz turning to whiskers on the sons of man, and coming up from the barn some warm Saturday evening, seeing the gangly little girl you'd known right from seed, suddenly appearing on the porch like her own lovely ghost, waiting and then hugging you around your neck that had to still smell of the horse you'd been shoeing, and saying, "Your supper will be cold, Daddy," and kissing her cheek, a woman with her mother in her eyes, and her own daughter there too, if you are wise enough to see that far. And time turning gray in your beard, and your hands like limp old claws turned hard with callous and age, and your fingers cracking in the death-like cold and healing with the earth under the healed places and cracking open again like fissures in the frozen ground, waiting for the renewal of spring to restore what is held in abeyance back to the tender and fecund flesh, another winter. For time here wasn't generally referred to in years, but rather in the winters we have lived through. The sun is low, and the warmth is brief, and the light lives on between the dark and the dark. So.
I'm going to try this without my glasses, but I'll have them handy.
You're right.
That second winter with that filly of hers, I tried to make Elizabeth understand well before the mare dropped the foal. I was too late in the year in our country for something to be born, too late for the little one to be able to gain enough strength to make it through the winter. How, when such a thing happened, as hard as it sounds, it was always best for both the mama and the little one to do away with the baby, so the mother can get back to herself before the bad cold set in and not prolong the life of the little one, no matter how strong it seemed at birth, because it would fight a painful battle with winter and lose. But the cold is always that much more powerful than the warmth, than the fragile heat of life. But no, she absolutely refused to hear of it, refused to even consider what I wanted her to understand, which at the root of it was the very law of the land. Red happened to be around the barn when the mare went down, shaken and all sweated through. She'd begun to tie up, which is something where an animal's muscles all seize up. We finally get hold of our vet, Stony Walls, just coming into his dinner, and he comes over and goes to work on her, and it seems as if one bad thing follows another. The mare can't seem to help herself with her hind end all bound up and all, and to top it all off, baby's going to come breech. Stoney's up inside of her trying to get the foal turned around some, it's just no damn good. And all the while, Elizabeth's kneeling close to the mare's head, rubbing up and down her neck whenever she quiets down some, thrashing about, making these god-awful groaning sounds, then resting back down again. Stoney finally gets the little one's hind leg started, and Red and I take over for him so he can take a breather. We're kneeling next to each other in the stall, drawing steadily against the little one's hind legs. We can finally see where it's a filly, for sure. It seems to hang up on something inside, and the mare thrashing and grunting against the thick hay we laid down. Stoney gets back between us, nudges us off to either side, and reaches back inside and gets the one foreleg that was bent straightened back out beneath the foal's chin, and he starts drawing against the soaking hind legs, and the baby suddenly slides out of her, knocking Stoney on his back and lying on top of it. He finally straightens up with the baby in his arms. He just sits there like that. "You all right?" I asked him. And then he tells me he just wants to make sure whatever blood that's left in the placenta gets into the foal before he cuts it loose from the mama. The mare is lying back with her head stretched out and Stoney ties off the cord and carries the foal into the next stall. Elizabeth brought him a couple of blankets, and he wraps the baby up in it and kneels in the corner with his arms around it and his head over his shoulder. And I can still see its lovely little face with his big eyes blinking with wonder, as if it was thinking to itself, so this is life. So this is what the fuss is all about. Elizabeth stays with the baby, and Stoney draws off the mare's first milk and then tube feeds it into the foal through its nostril to be sure she gets all of it into her stomach. Past 9 o'clock, and I send Red home because he's got a full day in the morning, and of course I do too, but as it turns out, the night has just begun. When an animal ties up like that, its kidneys will eventually shut down, which will lead to its death. So our only chance of keeping a mare alive is to keep running the fluids into her until she's urinating properly, which should indicate that her kidneys are still okay, but then it's still a damn crapshoot, because if there's been too much muscle damage, she wouldn't be any good for herself anyway. But Stoney had come prepared for the long haul. He'd brought several cases of those electrolyte fluid bags along with a week's supply of milk replacement for the baby. And he gets himself all set up like he knows that tomorrow's a hell of a long ways off, but he still intends to be there with the mare alongside him, and that they'll both see the morning together. He sews a catheter into her jugular vein and then hangs the first of the clear plastic bags from a hook he screwed into an overhead beam. And then he attaches a long transparent tube that goes from the bottom of the bag into the portal at the mare's neck. And I watch with him for a few minutes as the liquid begins to drip and fall. Elizabeth's mixed up a batch of that milk replacement. She's got a baby bottle of it with a rubber nipple, and she's sitting in the next stall talking to the foal, rubbing its forehead, trying to get it interested in what she's got to offer. I kneel down with her and tell her that I'll get the baby started, and could she get Stoney some dinner? Which reminds both of us we hadn't had our own yet either. Well, the baby keeps nosing around the bottle in my hand with that wonderful soft skin of the newborn. And I'm sitting there like Elizabeth had been and probably mumbling some of that same foolishness in her ear. And I watch her eyes wide and new in her eyelashes when she blinks. It somehow makes me smile. She finally gets it into her head to try to find the nipple and begins drawing at it with those lovely eyes of hers going back and forth and every now and again looking right at me. Looks to me like she found her a daddy, and I look up and I see Stoney standing there with his arms crossed on his chest and a big smile on that mug of his. Mare's quiet. We'll just keep running the fluids to her as long as it takes. The baby finishes another bottle of the milk substitute and then just puts its chin down on its forelegs and closes its eyes and goes to sleep. And I move away and close the stall door real quiet-like so as it can take its rest. We all eat in the runway between the stalls so Stoney can keep an eye on the mare. He's got three of those fluid bags strung up together and hanging there so it gives us time to eat our dinner. But while we're still at it, there's a thrashing from the baby's stall. And we look in at her, just beginning to get her legs. She gets up, her hind legs under her, and nearly locked and pauses like that, quivering. But when she goes to rise up off her elbows, she rocks back and falls over. She'll do her, I say. It's always been a miracle to me, the birth. And then seeing them make themselves stand upright, and soon after bouncing and jumping around like they've been practicing their locomotion for months instead of just hours. Elizabeth crouches in the corner beside the little thing as it somehow forces itself back into the same position, pushing up, its hind legs all a quiver, and with its little tail sucked right flat against its butt. Elizabeth slides her open hands under its belly, not hardly touching it, and as it pushes off its front, she supports underneath it so that all four legs are straight and locked. It hesitates for just a moment, still trembling, with its new little muscles that only an hour or so ago had been something to paddle with. And then it extends one foreleg for its first step, and then falls back down again, flat on its face. "Don't take very much to learn to fall," Stoney says quietly beside me. "But to get back up again," I say, "the will to get back up." "Yeah," Stoney says. for each and every one of us, I reckon. And inside myself, I say it. Amen. And then again, amen. We get Stoney all fixed up with a pillow on that ancient great-grandma's quilt that must weigh 14 or 15 pounds at least. Elizabeth feeds her filly again, which had been sleeping on its side, weary from the hard journey it had traveled all that evening, all the way from that far inland sea, which is all it had ever known before being cast up on a rough and fearful shore of soft, dark hay. And then more wondrous and frightening, amid the quiet hours of myriad discovery, it had found itself not sea creature at all, but something apparently unsuited to its new environment. A fragile, tottering, stick-legged thing, having known its first hunger, and then perhaps its first dream of independence, and of unimagined places, too, that its legs, once they worked more harmoniously, might take it. For it had finally managed its first few precarious steps, and known warmth again after its startling discovery of the cold, and had found again the familiar darkness after its incomprehensible discovery of light. And there appeared to be many mothers for its choosing, none that slept beside it just then, but many kindly mothers nonetheless. Stoney tells Elizabeth that he'll feed the baby through the night as long as he's right there, because she'll no longer have such a luxury after he leaves. But no, she says, she reckons where she'll be in that baby stall every 2 hours for the next 3 days, and then she'll proceed from there onward until the poor little thing is ready for weaning. And I can see right then and there that this whole event is about to provide a passel of learning experience for someone. And as I walk back up to the house by myself, I figure I'm probably the one that's about to be re-educated. For Elizabeth seems to know just precisely where this whole affair is headed. And I'll be damned if she isn't up and down all night long those first few days. And when a filly can finally go for 4 whole hours between feedings, it almost seems like a vacation, at least to me and our alarm clock. It's like when you get a spate at 20 or 30 below zero weather and it sets in real good and firm sometime after the new year. Why, I rise up, say, 5 below, it's near to almost being downright tropical. And a day that actually makes it all the way back up to zero, well, that's practically shirt sleeve weather. Making you wonder when you leave the house if you really do need your coat or not. And although you still got nearly 5 months to go, you know that spring is absolutely inevitable, and hellfire, while man's hopefulness can just about rise on rosy new wings unfettered. I've already finished shaving it. I'm nearly dressed when the alarm goes off for the 6 o'clock feeding. I tell Elizabeth I'll take care of that one and I'll see her by supper time. As I enter the stall, the barn, all is quiet. I creep past the baby stall and see that she's asleep with her legs stretched out straight as if she were dreaming of standing squarely upright. And then I look in at the mare and Stoney, and I'll be, I whisper to myself. The lights over each of the stalls are off, but the ones that are spaced further apart over the runway are still on. The last one is opposite the mare's stall so that the baby lies in near darkness, but a dim half-light spreads over most of Stoney and the mama. He's got the fluid dripping at a slower rate, and of the 3 bags that hang there, she's almost finished with the second one. I guess Elizabeth fixed only some food at 4 o'clock, because a couple of empty plates were stacked one on top of the other and pushed off to one side with a fork laid across them, and Stoney is sitting with his back against the wooden partition and his legs out before him, and with the mare's face lying across his lap. He's still got that quilt wrapped about his shoulders, and it's nearly fallen off of one side of him. His left arm is turned away from the horse, with the fingers of that hand almost touching a saucer that holds an empty teacup, as if he just had time to set it down before sleep had finally overtaken him in mid-stride, so to speak. His other arm lies across the mare's neck, and his face rests on her head. And they're both sound asleep. All God's creatures, I think to myself as I stand there watching them, and the beauty of it, of the oneness of all life, just about freezes me so that I'm almost afraid that if I blink, I might disturb them. All God's creatures. Shall I read another
story?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe Joe can sing.
It's absolute that Joe can't sing.
Yeah, I kind of blew through that.
This is called Angels. This is also in the book. She came on the train with her folks for the waters.
I'm gonna have some of your water, okay?
It's yours.
Goddamn.
I'm used to living by the sea.
It's dry for here.
She came on the train with her folks for the water, for the mineral hot springs in the southern part of the state. Her daddy suffered from the lumbago, and in those days it was thought to be a cure, and two, the journey would be another facet of her education before she went back to one of those girls' colleges. She was 19 years old. Of course, I was young too then, 24, set to go back for my last year of schooling, my book learning. But I still knew horses better than anything else, and that last summer I'd taken a work on a beautiful big spread at the foot of the Medicine Bows, breaking and training new mounts they would use to work their cattle with, while my own folks were still busy with their hay fields up to home. I've been able to talk sense to animals, especially to horses, since I was a boy. And in the early evenings, when her folks had retired before dinner, she'd come out by herself and watch me working the young broke creatures in the big corral. I remember the red circle of the sun setting against the crook of the mountains directly in my eyes as I was whispering something against the cheek of this lovely 2-year-old bay colt, with my right arm resting over his back and my left hand open and gentle-like along the ridge of his face. And every so often he snorts like he's getting ready to throw me away from him, and I just keep talking to him, rubbing softly up and down the bridge of his nose, and he snorts again, but he forgets to leap away because he can't stop listening to what I'm telling him. And who knows how long I stand there like that with my arm across him and my hand on him and talking softly, and all the while I watch his eye and his ears, which go from wanting to lay back and fling me aside to tentatively standing upright to listen to the softness of my voice. And his eye, too, I remember, watching his eye change when he finally decided I wasn't going to be a danger to him. At first, his brow lifted up, and he snorted at me with his eye big, showing all its white, and then finally the brow relaxing with his ears. And I can see where he realizes that I'm somehow making sense to him, or at least it begins to sound pleasing and reassuring from under all his wildness. And he slowed down enough inside his fear to realize that my hands feel real good on him too. It's full dark on dusk, and I keep talking, rubbing the corners of his mouth as I stand in front of him so that he can watch into my eyes when he chooses to. But by now, I think he knows he can trust me. I've got this length of rawhide that my granddad had given me when I was a boy, and I move it slowly past his teeth so as he can taste it along with my fingers with his tongue. And then I make one turn with it around the back of his lower jaw, Indian fashion, and then step back along his flank, still talking to him all the while. I rub his back down from his withers and keep talking to him, leaning against the barrel of his body with more and more pressure until I'm leaning my full weight against him. He walks ahead a few paces with some concern, as if to get out from under. He's actually dragging me, hanging off of him with my arms across his back. He stops, and I lead my right arm over him, and holding both ends of the rawhide rein snubbed up in my left hand, and without altering the calm reassurance of what I'm telling him, I slide up onto his back. And I feel him lock his knees, and his ears come back, and then go forward again, and he snorts once and kind of bounces once or twice, stiff-legged like that, and then he just kind of relaxes and walks me over to the fence where Elizabeth is perched up on the top railing, watching us with this funny expression on her face. Not a frown, but not really smiling either, in a green sweater.
I'll never forget that green. The green coat sweater. Isn't that foolish after all these years? Back across the dark where the lanterns hang off the central lodge building, where the hands eat at one long table, and the foreman and his family and the guests at another, the old familiar clashing of the iron triangle calls everyone to come and eat, and Elizabeth walks a pace or two ahead of me as I walk behind her, coiling up my length of rawhide. And then she stops and turns, and I walk up alongside her, and she says, "They always seem to trust you, don't they?" And I say, "Ma'am?" And she says, "The horses. They seem to trust you because you don't try to trick them, do you?" It's too dark to see her eyes, and I say, "No, ma'am, I just put myself in their place when we start to work with each other until we both seem to understand what the others think." "Well, I think they're lucky," she says. And I say, "Ma'am?" And she says, "The horses. I just think they're lucky." And I mumble mostly to myself as we approach the wide veranda. "Well, I reckon I probably am too." We don't really get to talk again because their stay at the ranch is over. They're bound back east. And I'm headed north to home and then my own last year of school, where I'd been studying for the law in Cambridge, Massachusetts, of all places. But as they say, the die seemed already to have been fixed and cast, without me even understanding the wheels that had been set in motion, probably a long time before I looked up, squinting into the setting sun and smelling not unlike raw dust and rank horse hide. My last night home, I'm packing up my satchel and the books I'll be taking back. I remember my father and me up and leaving sometime before 4 a.m, bound down to Cheyenne where the railhead's at. And my ma comes in and sits on my bed with a stack of clean clothes she's brought up, all folded perfectly, like another stack of books, but soft and warm from her ironing. And without looking at her, as I'm arranging everything in my case, I say, "You know, I met this very lovely girl down at the White Cross, and I think I'm going to marry her." And when the words come out into the air like that, with the yellow lantern light on my ma sitting on the corner of my bed, it kind of shocked me even more than her. It scared me too, I have to say, when I heard myself say it right out loud, because I hadn't had the time or probably for all that the courage to dwell on it. But when I heard the words myself, it was as if I was just repeating what was already been written and signed and sealed and delivered, even though I never even stopped to wonder if Elizabeth had gotten the same message herself. But I have to say that it didn't hardly take any wondering about anyway, like it was already a complete and finished thing, even though it hadn't hardly even begun yet. "Ma," she says, "I met this beautiful girl. I'm going to marry her." I'd start out at South Station in Boston on Sunday afternoons, then back again on the last train every Sunday night, all through the fall and winter, with me in my old hat and my boots and my sheepskin that was permanently soiled from years of working and feeding animals in it. Her folks weren't all that thrilled with me as a prospect for their daughter, an interloper in a cowboy hat who walked bow-legged and strange boots and talked like he'd come from a foreign country, which Wyoming, even though they had had a taste of it, surely was, next to the neat and orderly town of their Puritan forebears, with the ocean close to where they had lived all their lives, bordering on the southern edge of their spectrum of familiarity by New York City and on the northern edge by Boston. And when they seen I probably wasn't to be put off by obstacles of distance and inconvenience, they wasn't too happy. Elizabeth says they were midway through their dinner, each of them dwelling on their food, when the wild sounds of this snowstorm that was more like a blizzard seemed to batter at the front of the house. And Elizabeth looks up and around. And Mr. Putnam glances down the table at his daughter, and then he says to Mrs. Putnam, "Carrots, please, dear." And her mother says, "It's just the oak limb against the roof, dear." But Elizabeth hears it again and excuses herself from the table and walks quickly toward the door, opens it to me, standing there all crusted with snow up and down my face and coat, and she yanks me into the foyer with the wind blowing the snow into the little room and slams the door behind me. She doesn't say anything, wiping the snow from my face and helping me unbutton my coat, for it's at least a 3-mile walk from the train station. Then finally she says, "Don't you have any sense at all?" And I say, "Ma'am, you mean this little perturbation of weather?"
Why, this is the first evening I felt at all at home since before I left the mountains. And she's standing there before me, just barely shaking her head with her mouth set, and that look in her eyes that is almost a scolding, and says, and I say, and besides, I want to marry you. And her eyes change back, and she tugs on either side of my open coat with her fists against my chest, and the snow just beginning to melt onto her arms. And I say, will you? And she looks up at me and just barely tips her head, nowhere even close to a nod, and whispers, yes. And I just remember saying, well then. And with my hat still in my hand, and without thinking, I open and close the door behind me, lurching down the stairs back out into the storm. And with the wind driving the snow under my open coat, my hat still clutched in my hand as I plod away in the darkness, wondering, what in God's name had I done? I shared room. No, I didn't want. We got to get him married, don't we?
Before he goes all the way back to Wyoming.
And I shared rooms with Jeffrey Stewart Coolidge III, and he lends me his old Plymouth for the occasion, pressing the keys into my hand and telling me that I don't have to take a train to my own damn wedding. This is early in spring, in April, and there's already buds up in the soft earth. And I remember thinking, how back home? There's still at least another good month of winter to go. Friday, April 10th. I leave Cambridge that morning with my plan already in hand. For the night before, as I'm studying Coolidge's roadmap, I notice the name, somewhere north of New York City, maybe 30 or 40 miles it looks like, and the symbolism or whatever just seems to fall into place because I really had no idea at all where we should do this thing. Elizabeth is watching for me out the window, and as I pull up in front of the house, she comes down the walk with a little overnight bag and wearing that green sweater again, which made me glad when I saw it, helping me to forget some of my own nervousness as I remember her sitting up on that corral rail in the last of the twilight when I'd gotten that stud colt gentle. As we hoped, neither her folks nor her sister were at home, and we were off, headed for western skies. She hugged me around my neck, tipping my hat off my head into the back seat. Coolidge made me wear one of his fine suits with a necktie and a vest and all, but still permitting me my boots and my hat so that I won't feel completely out of my own self. And Elizabeth's just plain excited, with her arm through mine and pressed up beside me as I continue to drive on with both my hands gripping the wheel, watching straight ahead and hoping to God we're doing the right thing. Although I knew all the way back in September when I said it to my ma that we were. We passed a signpost directing travel toward New York City, and I go off on a different road, and Elizabeth asks me if I know where I'm going, and I say, I think so. She says, where? And I say, Valhalla, real serious-like, as if it were the standard and expected destination for anyone bound on such a mission as ours. But I finally have to smile in spite of myself, hearing me say it. And she says, Valhalla? And I say, yes'm, Valhalla, New York. For this is probably the single most foolhardy, not to say risky, undertaking of my young life, and even considering all the other unpredictable and untamed animals I've ever been associated with. And Valhalla, I read somewhere, is where they take the dead heroes. We arrive early in the afternoon and we drive to where someone directed us to a town hall. We go into the little information office and the woman sends us across the corridor to the other office, and I ask the fellow there for a license. And he says, what kind? Dog or fishing? Then he looks at the two of us and smiles and says, we're marriage, because I sell them all. And I say, we'll take marriage. And then I asked him where I could find a justice of the peace, and he says there's only one. But right now he's the presiding judge at the trial, but he's the justice of the peace too. And he told me where the trial was being held, and we walked over in accord to his instructions. It was a real big store, kind of like one of them co-op type places, with burlap sacks of feed and seed and shelves of hardware and paint and linseed oil
Back along one side, utensils and brushes of every imaginable size and shape, and further down, shelves of canned goods, amongst bins of nails and tools and whatever else you could think of. But the whole center of the store had been cleared away, where rows of chairs were all set, with what looked like the whole town sitting there. We were holding each other's hand as I opened the door, and we step inside, closing it behind us, and looking down this long, hall-like room, crowded with rows of chairs, all filled up with the townspeople. And they all turn around as one to see what had just come through the door. The trial was apparently right at its height, and the judge, this little guy with a bald head and spectacles and a little mustache, looks up way down the rows of people, and he says, "What do you want?" Some truck driver had accidentally killed a woman in the wintertime, and he was on trial for having caused her death. We're standing there in our, with our backs against the door like a couple of greenhorns, and Elizabeth squeezes my hand, and she kind of presses up against me, and I look down this blank sea of crowded faces, all turning, looking back at us, and at the little guy at the table down front, leaning over his hands, peering over the top of his spectacles at us. And I even remember smelling the linseed and turpentine, and thinking how those kind of smells are the same everywhere, from here all the way back to home. And I say, what seems a little too loudly when it comes out, "We want to get married." Then all the faces turn back around to the judge. And after considering a moment, he says, "Okay." And he stands up and says, "Come on down here, young people." And we walk down the center aisle through all these strangers, still holding hands. There's flour on the floor and the unmistakable smell of brine where two great pickle barrels sat behind the judge's table and the lingering aroma of turpentine from the other end of the store. And I think I can also smell that dry, sharp taste of fresh cheese, for I'm also powerful hungry. And for a moment, with all turned around, we know we are absolutely and unquestionably in the proper and correct place, with all of our nameless neighbors in their crowded pews, and the judge, who we later found out was also a furniture salesman, standing in front of his table with both his hands raised and open in front of him like a kindly shepherd of the flock, ready to send us off in the right direction with the blessings of all who are assembled. And something, too, has transformed all the congregation that for 3 hours previous, at a murder trial with one of their own accused, and the aggrieved, along with the victim's bereaved family, that with the opening and closing of a door and the entrance and procession of two very young and somewhat abashed strangers who have appeared inexplicably in their midst for some reason which is only their own, unexpectedly, all those assembled have now become witnesses also to a wedding, thrusting them instantaneously from the dull, somber consideration of death to the happy acknowledgement of the unlimited potential of life, from despair unto hopefulness, like the passing of angels. Elizabeth presses up against my side as we proceed down the aisle to the diminutive man who awaits us. He speaks something to two people in the front row of chairs, one on either side of the aisle, and as we stand before him, the prosecuting attorney stands up beside me as my best man. And the defense attorney rises and stands up beside Elizabeth as her full-bearded bridesmaid. The judge says his words, speaking to each of us in turn, and we responding to him, to his words. And then, in a kind of panic I've never known in my life, I search frantically in my pants until I finally retrieve the hidden object and hand it to the judge, who continues to instruct us and then gives it back to me. And I turn to Elizabeth as she turns to me, and I place the golden ring about her finger and hold her hand in my own to steady it, and my own too, I expect. And the judge speaks again, and we face him, and then we turn back to one another and embrace and kiss. And the whole transformed courtroom of strangers, including accused and accuser, still more than a little stunned at their sudden and unlikely change of perspective, the whole stunned and silent congregation suddenly erupts in a din of applause and cheers as, now wedded, we flee down the aisle and disappear out the same door we came from, like the passing of angels.
Wow.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.